Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
Hey, you're about to hear a rebroadcast of the Colin McEnroe Show. It was originally recorded on July 3rd of 2019.
A shark is attracted to the exact kind of splashing and activity that occurs whenever human beings go in swimming. You cannot avoid it.
If you open the beaches on the 4th of July, it's like ringing the dinner bell, for Christ's
sake. Look, Mr. Vaughn, I pulled a tooth the size of a shot glass out of the wrecked hull of a boat out there, and it was the tooth of a great white.
Look, we depend on the summer people here for our very lives.
You are not going
and
to have
if you
a summer
close those
unless
beaches,
you deal with this
finished.
Problem. We're not only going to have to close the beach, we're going to have to hire somebody to kill the shark.
All right, so we're talking about sharks today, but maybe a little bit more about how they interact with people. Although, one thing I want to say, and I'm going to say it more than once today, sharks are amazing animals, and they're really, really fascinating and kind of mysterious. There's much more that we don't know about them than what we do know about them. There's so much to be studied about them. And they're in much more danger from us than we are from them. But like the only thing anybody cares about, 99% of our interest in sharks is whether they're going to attack us or not. That's like all we care about. And you can sort of understand that. And it's certainly no laughing matter anymore. They're driven by climate change and other factors and migration patterns. They are around the beaches from North Carolina, certainly all the way up to New England, more than they ever have been before. In 2016, we had a death up in Cape Cod. So we're going to talk, let me just tell you, in the second segment today, we'll be talking a little bit more about what people think they can do about shark attacks and whether any of those things are particularly realistic. And we will talk a little bit more about the marine biology of the shark. We'll also be talking in the final segment to somebody who's been with us before, the naturalist Cy Montgomery, who has done one of those things where you go in a cage I think off the coast of Mexico, with a great with the great white shark near the cage, and what it's like to experience this animal in a relatively safe but terrifying environment. But right now, we'd like to talk to somebody who's kind of on the front lines of this whole question of what happens when the beach activity gets humming, as it is now, in an area where sharks are known to go hunting after seals. Greg Johnson is a school teacher, musician, and artist who paints whale murals and a longtime lifeguard at Nauset Beach in Orleans, Cape Cod. He's competed in the life-saving world championships in the Netherlands in 2016, and in advance warning, cell service is really tough on Cape Cod in certain places, and I think he might be in the parking lot at Nauset right now trying to hold on to a signal. Greg Johnson, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
I guess maybe the place to begin is, has your job changed more over the last few years as the presence and visibility of sharks around Cape Cod has been more of an issue?
Yeah, Colin, our job has changed significantly. I kind of like to sum it up by saying we went from sort of a Baywatch scene to a MASH unit, where most of our training is about, you know, how to apply a tourniquet and how to use a blood-absorbent gauze and, you know, all the things you're going to do in the aftermath of a potential, you know, a shark attack. What if it does happen? Whereas earlier on in the days, 70s, 80s, 90s, I've been here since 1979, most of our training was geared towards, you know, making water rescues with a Peterson belt. So, yeah, we're more leaning towards the first aid end of things due to the appearance of sharks here on our beaches.
Have you had to, you probably heard that clip from Jaws at the beginning talking about how the activity on a beach is exactly what might attract a shark. And we should also say that where people like to go swimming is kind of like where sharks like to maybe be. And if they're going to bite, they might be biting right there. So have you guys had to change the rules about where and when people do swim at your beach?
We have posters at our toll booth where people drive in, you know, to pay a parking fee. And there's posters all along the boardwalks of sharks, which clearly state, don't swim alone, don't swim at night, stay in waste water or even less. We're trying to keep people on the sandbars. We don't let people go in over their head anymore. And if they do start to wander off, we have to, you know, blow our whistles and get people back in. So there's still the problem, though, with, yeah, we protect maybe a half a mile or more of by those areas. We really can't tell people what to do. So you still get people swimming off the protected beaches in waters that are pretty dangerous. And it's funny that this interview is happening right now, Colin, because we just had a pod of seals go by us heading north. And a short while later, we saw another shadow in the water that we can see from our towers. And it was clearly a shark slowly following the pod of seals north, maybe 50 yards off the public beach.
So, and just to emphasize what Greg is saying, for those of you who haven't been to the Cape, so there are these beautiful national seashore beaches like Nauset, but then you get off that beach and you can walk north quite a bit up the arm of the Cape, and there are a lot of places that aren't patrolled, have no lifeguards, and people probably feel free to do whatever they want and take whatever risks they want to do. And so, and Greg, that must be kind of frustrating, not only that they do it in those areas that aren't protected, but, you know, the only thing that you're trying to do is keep people from being bitten by sharks. And it seems like people are notoriously not willing to obey rules anyway.
Yeah, I'm not really sure why. People got to be watching the news, TV, and, you know, like your show right now, they got to be listening, at least that there's more and more fatalities due to sharks here in New England now, that, you know, it's really starting to get out of control. And, you know, I think we have close to 150 sharks that have been tagged already. But according to Greg Scalmo, the shark expert around here, that number is probably double or more with sharks they haven't tagged. So why you would swim out far with those kind of statistics is kind of mind-boggling. I don't understand why people don't listen. Maybe they're not afraid. I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of denial. People think it won't happen to me. It'll happen to somebody else. And then there's a whole bunch of worry wards who are constantly worried that it's going to happen to them, and maybe not a good in between. So if somebody is, so let's say that dark shadow following the seal pod takes a little bit of a left turn, goes inward and does attack somebody in the swimming area. There's a tremendous risk to you if you were to run in there toward the shark activity while the shark is still active, right?
Yes and no. We are instructed by our administrators, if there is a shark attack, not to go in unless the scene is safe. Kind of a tough call and a judgment call. But the statistics show, according to Greg Scalmo, that once a shark bites a human, they're no longer interested. It's not what they want to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And that the rescuer coming out to help that other person, statistically, they will not go after the rescuer, which was a good thing to hear of Scalmo. During Scalmo's talk, but it's still, that's a question whether we would want to go in or we wouldn't. Most of us are saying we can't just sit there and people are going to expect us to react to an attack. So why are you sitting there? So I think a lot of us are saying, I'm going to go in. A lot of other people are a little afraid to do it, but I think it's a judgment call and a total situational thing as to, you know, how close is the shark after the bite? Is that person still in sight? Are they asking for help? You know, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of a judgment call, I think.
So one of the things that people like to do at Cape Cod is surf, and you've surfed in the past. And obviously this involves putting yourself out in deeper water, out towards that dark shadow following the pod of seals. So tell me, first of all, I would imagine from everything you're saying so far, you're not quite the surfer you used to be.
I haven't surfed in over 2 years, at least by myself. When there's a group of them, you feel a little bit safer. But there's a big surf community here on Cape Cod. A lot of local surfers still surf. They surf in numbers. They have kind of a surfers alliance going where they get together and have meetings and talk about, you know, shark safety and where and when do we go surfing, that kind of a thing. But they're not willing to give up their livelihood. You know, they love surfing so much and they don't want to give it up because there's a potential danger of sharks in the water. But, you know, I sort of understand it, but I personally haven't been in over 2 years surfing myself. So I'm a little bit skeptical.
Greg, there's also kind of a minor industry growing up around things that might deter a shark, you know, something you could wear, or maybe a zebra-striped surfboards. I don't know why sharks would be afraid of zebras, but are you, A, seeing any of that, and B, do you put any stock in any of those ideas?
There's a few of the lifeguards here that wear some kind of a ankle bracelet that gives off an electrical impulse or something, and I don't know that I buy into any of that. Like you said, I mean, what's the difference if your surfboard or your wetsuit has stripes up and down? I don't know. Maybe there's some scientific truth to that, but I don't see a lot of that being done around here, at least on Cape Cod. Maybe they do in Australia or out in California, but I don't see a lot of that kind of behavior with the humans in reaction to the shark. So I don't know what's going on with that whole, but it's not catching on.
I guess, you know, the other thing, I spent a lot of my childhood visiting the Cape, and yeah. There are dangerous ocean currents, particularly as you got, you know, from Nauset up towards Coast Guard Beach and then some of the Wellfleet beaches. I mean, you really got some big ocean waves there. And people like that. They like to go body surfing and stuff like that. But, I mean, there are dangers, and a riptide can pull you quite a bit further out. And that's what your job, I assume, used to be, riptide, undertow. People get too far out. They're too tired to swim back, stuff like that. Now you would be putting yourself in considerable danger going out to that person. So how do you guys handle that?
Well, every year after the winter storms have done their thing, the beach is a different beach every time I come here. Every summer there's a different kind of sandbar or rip current situation. A rip tide is something that is that's the term is rip current, Colin. I'm not trying to be
expert,
but there's a rip current that is just the ocean volume of the water that has to go back out to the sea. Once it travels over the sandbar, it finds a common channel to go back out. It's a real strong pull, strong current that people sometimes get sucked into and then get pulled out into. But we had a lot of those back in the early 1980s, and I'm looking at the beach from the top of the dune from the parking lot, and there's one very large rip current area. You know, it's sort of like a stream going out to sea that's between two sandbars. So the water travels over the bar and then has to travel back out somewhere, so it develops a, you know, one little stream area in which the current gets so strong that people very often, usually little kids or the elderly that aren't strong enough to fight it, and they get caught it and get pulled out. But as it is right now, the water is deeper in those areas, so we don't let people go in there. So right now we're kind of keeping that problem at bay, so we don't have to go in, keeping people out of the rip current areas. We have signs that we put up. There's a buoy right in the middle of it, and we keep people out of there now. So it's just being a preventive lifeguard as opposed to waiting for it to happen and then reacting.
Right. Well, it sounds like good lifeguarding to me. I hope, despite all these shadows in the water, that you can have a lovely and enjoyable summer. Greg Johnson, school teacher, musician, artist who paints whale murals, and longtime lifeguard at Nauset Beach in Orleans, Cape Cod. He competed in the life-saving world championships in the Netherlands in 2016. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. When we come back from this, we're going to talk a little bit more about the actual marine biology of the shark. I think the shark is an animal worth understanding in terms that are greater than whether or not he or she might bite us. But we'll also talk about the things that people think they might be able to do to avoid shark attacks, whether those things work.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of the Colin McEnroe Show. It was originally recorded on July 3rd of 2019.
This is a great white, Larry. A big one. And any shark expert in the world will tell you it's a killer. It's a man-eater.
Look, the situation is that apparently a great white shark has staked a claim in the waters off Amity Island. And he is going to continue to feed here as long as there is food in the water.
And there's no limit to what he's going to do. I mean, we've already had 3 incidents. 2 people killed inside of a week, and it's going to happen again. It happened before. The Jersey Beach.
1916, there were 5
people chewed up in the surf.
In 1 week.
All right. So you even hear that reference to 1916. That part of the movie was not entirely fanciful. But, you know, there's a way in which Jaws and movies like it, just they kind of define our whole vision of sharks. And it's 99% of our curiosity about sharks is tied to whether or not they're going to attack us. Sharks are really, as I said before, really interesting, mysterious animals. We'll talk a little bit about what you should be worried about and maybe what would help and what wouldn't help you. But I hope we can also talk just a little bit about sharks. per sharks, sharks qua sharks. Now, George Burgess is Director Emeritus of the Florida Program for Shark Research and Curator Emeritus of the International Shark Attack File based on the University of Florida campus. He's joining us now. So first of all, welcome to our conversation.
Good to be with you, Colin.
So, I mean, one thing that we could say with quite a bit of confidence is that sharks are in much more danger from us than we are from them. The body count is very, very lopsided in that regard. But, I mean, if you were going to explain to people how much of a risk there is of a shark attack at any given moment, what would you tell them?
Well, first of all, your point is well taken. Sharks kill about 6 people a year worldwide. Well, we kill about 100 million of them, so it's pretty obvious who's the predator in this relationship. But that said, your chances as an individual of being bitten, far less dying, are amazingly high. I calculated for a number of beaches in the United States, for instance, at almost 6 million to 1. So, you know, really, your chances of being injured or dying of other causes as related to aquatic recreations are always much, much higher than sharks.
Right. I mean, in fact, we were just talking to a lifeguard at Nauset Beach in 1973, August 1973. At Nauset Beach, there was a rip current that killed several dozen people. I mean, most of them got killed because they didn't know what to do in that situation. But that kind of gives you, you know, a ratio when you think about 6 shark-related deaths.
More people are killed crossing the road from the beach to the other side of the road to get a cold drink than are killed by sharks.
I'm assuming that we of the news media are probably more hindrance than help in all of this. I mean, it's important that people know about risks and know what's out there. But just like watching the TV news and stuff like that, I feel like I'm seeing a big effort to scare me out of my wits.
Yeah, absolutely. I was watching one of the major networks last night for their evening news, and they had as one of their major teases sharks being near people in the water in Florida, and sure enough, they showed some drone pictures of sharks swimming in the water amongst people, and I had to laugh because I'm based in Florida. You can see that every day, every hour, having been up in the air over the beaches many times. It's a standard practice down there. Of course, the visibility of the water is particularly good there, so you can see them more often. But anybody who's been in the water in Florida more than a couple times has probably been within 6 to 10 feet of a shark.
So I think we have to get into the area of anthropocentrism. You know, there's a considerable hue and cry that you hear from people around this time of year, basically saying, well, let's make the ocean safe for human beings, right? There's this kind of like, well, let's give all the seals vasectomies so there won't be as many of them and the sharks won't come to eat them. Let's put sonar pulses out in the water to scare seals and or sharks away. Let's do something. And it does kind of raise that question. What's the ocean there for? Is it there for people to go swimming in the summer, or is it there to be the ocean full of an entire ecosystem? Maybe you can philosophize a little bit about that for us.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. I think most people that enter the sea equate the experience with visiting their YMCA pool, and nothing could be farther from the truth. When we enter the sea, we're engaging in a wilderness experience. And it's no different than if we go hiking in the Rocky Mountains and where we are exposed to bears and mountain lions and snakes or whatever, or crossing the Serengeti Plain where we have tigers lions or elephants or leopards. When we enter the sea, we're entering a wilderness. And unlike both of those previous experiences, we can't even breathe underwater. So we bobbing around in the water, and to do so, we take off essentially all of our clothes and enter barefoot. And there we encounter animals that live in the sea. And using the shark as the focal point, our playground in the sea that stretch of water that goes down to about 6 feet deep, because that's where most people go because we want to keep our feet on the bottom. That stretch is our playground. But for many species of sharks, it's their dining room. And so we wouldn't think about visiting our neighbors at dinner time and walking in nearly naked into their dining room. And so we need to remember that that's what's happening when we enter the sea.
We talked at the beginning of our conversation about that body count. Sharks are a protected species. I assume great whites are a protected species. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what's been going on with their population over all these years.
Yeah, sharks have been the objects of either directed or indirected fisheries. Indirected meaning they get caught accidentally in other fisheries. And in the open sea, for instance, where there's big fisheries for tunas, and that's an important species in Massachusetts waters where we now have a white shark situation going on. The hooks that are baited for tunas and swordfishes also catch sharks, and the sharks die, and they aren't intended to be caught, but they die nevertheless. Same thing goes in other areas of the world, in all sorts of other fisheries, gillnet fisheries and other net fisheries. But there's also directed fisheries now aimed for sharks, because the fins of the sharks are worth a lot of money in Asian countries, Southeast of Asian countries. The shark fins have great value. They sell here in the United States for $25 to $30 a pound off a boat. Just take them off the fins off. They don't have to be refrigerated or anything because they're sent to Asia dried. So they're easy money for fishermen. And as a result, wherever you go in the world, and I've been in a number of third world places where a single shark fins will feed the entire village. Any shark that gets caught is a dead shark. And as a result, populations are declining around the world.
You know, I think what makes them even harder to protect, I mean, you can point to a protected species or an endangered species, and if it's a pretty little bird or some kind of, you know, desert mammal or something, you can get people kind of over onto the cause. I mean, sharks have a publicity problem. They do occasionally bite people, and sometimes they kill people. I would imagine, dating back from the time of 1916, Jaws was right about, right? That there was a shark problem in 1916. It's harder to get people to think of the shark as a being that we want to protect if we're also worried that it's going to kill us.
You're right. Sharks have an image problem. They could use one of those for hire guys that, you know, some congressman mm-hmm. hires after he's caught sleeping with his colleague's wife or whatever. So, they do have that problem. And as a result, in a lot of quarters, when there a shark problem occurs, and I'm calling it a problem when something sort of suddenly jumps to the forefront, such as what we're seeing in Cape Cod here in recent years, one of the initial reactions among many people is, let's go kill some sharks. And, of course, the idea there is that we'll kill the shark bit this person. But the chances, of course, of you finding the shark that did it are slim to none. It's just really basically a sacrificial kill where people feel better for trying to take an eye for an eye, even if it isn't the right shark. And that still underlies the thinking in some quarters. And of course, as a scientist who gets called in to deal with shark attack in various places in the world, one of my first things is I've got to tell people is you're not going to catch the shark. And the reality is that what we need to do is start modifying our behaviors rather than shark behaviors. Again, coming back to your earlier point that the sea is a wilderness and we're eco-tourists when we visit it.
And because we unfortunately do not necessarily think that way, another thing people are going to want to do is put up netting that somehow or other cordons off a part of the swimming area along the ocean, or wear something that has an electric current that goes through it, which maybe the shark won't like, or put an electric current on the ocean floor where we want to go swimming. I'm assuming none of those things are going to be particularly effective in stopping the great white who's blundered into your path.
Yeah, you're correct there. There's been a cottage industry that's developed in the last 10 or 15 years or so with people trying out different devices that they claim will keep us safe. And, most of the devices are only marginally effective, if at all. You mentioned putting up a net around an area. Now, that's an effective way if you have the correct kind of netting and moorings and so forth. That is a way you can protect a beach from sharks, and if you do it in small areas where the humans will swim in complete safety, that's fine. But those kind of netting only work in low energy situations, not where there's no surf. No, there's no big currents. And so, for instance, in the Massachusetts example, you get the full ocean surf coming in on the Cape there with the rip currents and so forth. Those would not stay in place as a result of those ocean energy situations. So it only works in very special situations where you got like a little bay that's a sheltered bay or something like that.
Right. We should say that using sonar buoys would be prohibited by the Marine Mammal Protection Act. I mean, there's some ways in which we, at least as a species, have agreed we're not going to mess with marine life too much, right?
Yeah, and in our sort of current example involving the white shark, it comes into play especially because the white shark is a protected species, and therefore we can't catch them. In regards to the marine mammals, as you so accurately noted, under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, no seals or can be touched. And so any thoughts of altering the behavior or the biology of a seal is an absolute no-no that would not work with the Endangered Species Act, and appropriately so, of course. And of course, one of the things we've seen with the addition of that act in the 1970s through today is that now those seals are beginning to gradually get back to their population levels of where they were 150 years ago or more before we killed them all off. And at the same time, the protection of the white shark is slowly allowing that one to go back to its normal levels before we overfished it. So as a result, what we're seeing now are returns to normal levels of both of those species along our east coast of the United States and the west coast as well. What we are going to see, of course, is that those marine mammals are now going to take over some of the areas that we have taken over from them in their absence. In other words, building their colonies, and we're going to see more white sharks attracted to those seal colonies because that's what they like to eat as adults. So we can fully expect that there's going to be, shall we say, a clash of cultures, and remembering that the one culture is a natural one in the sea, and the other one is an unnatural one, us entering the sea as we do.
Right. I mean, the people are relatively recent arrivals in this world, and we're sitting here going, hey, what are all these sharks doing here? And the sharks, of course, have been wondering the same about us for quite a while. And I'm assuming also another thing that's happening here is that because of climate change, the migratory pattern of some sharks, anyway, is changing. They're not going to maybe want to be in Florida. They're going to maybe gravitate a little bit more towards these northern waters.
Yeah, part of that is related more to the fact that they're mostly a cool water shark. Mm. And they're mostly a cool water shark in part because the things that they enjoy eating the most, in fact, have to eat the most, are the marine mammals, the seals. And seals, naturally, even before man came in and screwed it all up, didn't get much farther south than North Carolina in the wintertime because they can't live in warm waters. And, of course, there was at one time some seals that lived in the Caribbean, a special one called the monk seal. We killed them off. The last monk seal went extinct in the early part of the 20th century. So while the whites do travel down from New England waters down to Florida in the wintertime when the waters cool off down our way, they used to go into the Caribbean and eat the monk seals. But those being gone now, those movement patterns are not quite as effective as they were 150 years ago. But white sharks do migrate in some places. We know from tagging studies that white sharks have migrated, for instance, from South African waters all the way over to Australia.
Right, that's back. The entire expanse of the Indian Ocean. I mean, that's like
right.
a really long trip.
Yeah. Very long trip. We also know from tagging on our West Coast that the white sharks take vacations in Hawaii and come back. We haven't had any real cross-Atlantic sort of stuff demonstrated yet, but I'd be surprised if we don't.
Yeah, that thing about Hawaii is fascinating, that they leave their hunting grounds kind of along the California coast and for no obvious reason congregate in a certain area closer to Hawaii for a whole bunch of winter months and kind of hang out all in one place.
Right, they do that, and they have another place off of southern part of California, sort of in the middle of the sea where they aggregate as well. And our guesstimates, probably as most scientists would guess, is, you know, if animals aggregate, they're there for a reason. They're either going to aggregate because there's a good food source available at that time, or because they have a little lovemaking on their mind. And more than likely, the copulation that occurs between males and females, of course, sharks copulate. That copulation may occur in one or both of those areas.
Well, also, I mean, if they're too close to the California coastline, they see all these out-of-shape tourists in bathing suits, they're going to lose all interest in sex. No wonder they have to get off the coast to do this.
Yeah, hey, some people shouldn't wear bikinis.
You're right. So, George Burgess, one last question here. You know, we talked about all the things that don't work, but, you know, we had a lifeguard on at the beginning talking about from his tower being able to see a shadow coming, trailing after a pod of seals. Drones are like towers that move. I would imagine drones might be a little bit useful in at least giving people some warning about what's where in the ocean.
I think they offer a lot of promise. You know, here in Florida, again, the waters are pretty clear.
Yep.
And from flying over, I can tell you, you can see sharks very, very easily. So drones work very fine. In fact, the story last night that I saw in the news was built on drone footage of sharks near people. In years ago, I used to go to the beach and stay at a condominium where we were up two or three stories high, and I would sometimes sit there drinking a cool drink late in the day and look down on the water, and I could see these shapes moving up and down the beach. And one time I saw a very large shark, probably a tiger shark, moving through the area, so I ran down and yelled people to get out of the water because there were no lifeguards there. But in Florida, where there are lifeguards, they communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
When a shark is seen in the water, they'll pull the people out of the water, and then they call the next beach up from them, wherever the shark is headed, and say, hey, we've got one coming your way. And then they let their people back at the water once the shark leaves. So drones could work very well in many situations. And the question I have relative to New England waters is the water clear enough to see the sharks in the water? Because there's a lot more plankton in the water in those northern areas, and so the water isn't quite as clear.
All right. Well, thank you very much for this conversation, George Burgess, Director Emeritus of the Florida Program for Shark Research. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to tell a different kind of shark story. This has all been about people hoping to avoid meeting a shark. You're going to talk to somebody who sought out that encounter.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of the Colin McEnroe Show. It was originally recorded on July 3rd of 2019.
All right. So we've been talking about human and shark encounters. As I say, we could do an entire separate program just about the marine biology of sharks and all the mysteries about them. I mean, we really don't know to what degree they are social. We know they do congregate. We don't really exactly know why they migrate. There are theories. We don't know how they navigate over those huge distances. You heard George Burgess talk about how they'll go from Australia to South Africa. I mean, that's a long distance. We don't really know what they do with their time. When they're on some of those little vacations they take, they dive into incredibly deep ocean water, maybe down 2,000-3,000 feet. But we don't know what they do when they get down there. But 99% of our curiosity about sharks has to do with whether or not they are going to attack us. And there's a lot more to them than that. A good way of getting into a conversation with Cy Montgomery, a naturalist and the author of 28 books for adults and children, including, most relevantly to us, because it's one of our favorite shows ever, The Soul of an Octopus. This is a book that inspired us to do a show with Cy about this exact topic. And she's written an essay in one of our favorite, if not our favorite, online publications, despite our failure to ever figure out how its name is pronounced. But it's either Aeon, Ion, or Eon. The essay is titled Danger Girl, What I Learned About Fear, Sex, Desire, and Dread from the Peculiar Pleasures of Diving with Great White Sharks. Welcome back to our show. First of all, Cy Montgomery.
Oh, I'm delighted to join you again.
Well, now we've left friendly, intelligent, fascinating octopuses, and we've moved on to scary sharks. But maybe we haven't moved all that far. So let's begin by saying that, having you say a little bit about the experience that you sought out. Many people like to do this. Not everybody, obviously. We'll get into why that is. But you went into a cage in a place where you knew sharks were going to come see you.
Yes. In fact, this was at the place that George was just speaking about off Guadalupe Island, off Mexico and California, which is sort of known as a shark cafe where sharks often meet. And there's beautiful clear waters there. So it's an ideal spot to see great whites. Now, I had gone with Greg Skomal several times to look at sharks and watch him tag them in Cape Cod, but you know that water is so soupy and green, and I really, after seeing these gorgeous animals, after seeing them in the soupy green water and being with Craig, I really longed to kind of get up close and personal in clear blue water. So I went on a boat with a group of, well, I was one of four women and 17 men who were going to go cage diving. Just right off the coast of Guadalupe Island. And what you do is you don all these weights on your chest and your feet, and then you go into a cage underwater and you're breathing through a regulator. I mean, right there is a bunch of stuff that many people might not want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And folks on the deck of the boat offer the sharks delicious chunks of tuna,
mm-hmm,
so that they will come by and you can take a look at them. And I've got to tell you, before I even went in, my heart was pounding. I did not know if I was going to be scared to death. I didn't know if I was going to be thrilled to death. And at that time, I didn't know that fear and desire often are processed in the same parts of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it was both. But when I got into the cage and looked around, I was pretty nervous, but I was nervous that I wouldn't see a shark, that I'd gone all that way for nothing. And so after a few minutes of just looking around at the blue, there it was. It was as if the ocean had gathered itself into the shape of a shark and become alive in front of me. And he swam toward me. We know you can see if it's a male or a female in that kind of clear water. And it turned out it was a shark. The first shark was one that's known to researchers. He's named Jacques, after Jacques Cousteau. And what I felt when I saw that shark swimming toward me was so surprising. I did not feel any fear at all. I felt tremendously excited, but at the same time, a sense of of peace washing over me, as if this gorgeous creature who looked to me like a knight in white satin, you know, they have that silvery gray top and this beautiful pure white as driven snow underside and a dark black eye. And here he was coming toward me. He glanced into my face, and it wasn't as if there was any malice in it at all. He just took a look at me and swam past and got to have a bite of tuna and swam on.
So
it was magnificent.
And but it must have been interesting if he really kind of cocked an eye at you.
Yeah, he just noticed me. You know, most of the time when people get bitten, it's because the shark makes a mistake, and it's often in water that they really can't see. And one of the things that many people don't realize about these sharks is when you have to kill everything you eat with your face, it's a really good idea right before you make contact with your meal to shut your eyes. And that's what they do. So if that happens, and particularly if you're in murky water, you know, they do make mistakes. And, I mean, it can be a really serious mistake. But when you compare it to the 250,000 to possibly 400,000 people every year who die because of hospital errors, they make mistakes very infrequently. And nobody wants to get rid of hospitals.
Right.
I mean, we shouldn't get rid of sharks.
Right. When we talked to George a little bit about this, too, that people, and some of it is driven, I think, by the news media, part of it, and some of it driven by movies that we actually love to go see and be scared by. There are all kinds of reasons for it, but there's a way in which we've inflated the danger of sharks. And at the same time, having talked to the Cape Cod lifeguard, also managed to minimize it in our own minds so that we will go swimming in a place where we really might get bitten by a shark. And at the same time, we've inflated this danger way out of proportion to what the real danger is compared to everything else, which is, I think, what you're suggesting.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I looked up some numbers. I did a book called The Great White Shark Scientist. And when this came out a few years ago, I looked up some numbers. And the number of Americans injured by toilets in 1 year is 43,000. No one's afraid of a toilet. The number of Americans injured by buckets and pails in that same year, which was 1996, 11,000. And then you look at the number of Americans injured by sharks of all species, and it's like nothing. It's ridiculous to be worried about this. What we should be worried about is global climate change.
Right. And I mean, we talked a little bit about that, too. That's affecting them, and it may be actually putting them and us on collision courses that didn't exist previously. So, Simon Montgomery, I guess maybe I also want to just talk to you a little bit about, as a person who writes a lot about the natural sciences, what interests you about sharks? To me, they're very mysterious. They have comparatively large brains, but I don't think we know too much about their intelligence, even if there was a way to think about their intelligence the way that we think about other kinds. They do these incredible migrations. We're not 100% sure why they always do that. They take these deep dives. We don't know what happens when they do that. They can live to be 70, which is an amazing idea, a great white shark that's 70 years old. I mean, what have you, A, found out about sharks that has kind of blown your mind, and what do you find ultimately still the most mysterious about them?
Well, there's a fellow named Sam Gruber who has done some work on intelligence on sharks and found that they are quite intelligent. They are as intelligent as, you know, a medium-sized mammal like an antelope. In fact, he's done experiments with mazes with sharks, and not only are they very good at memorizing the maze, but he set one maze up for the U.S. Navy, and then the funding ran out and years went by. He still had his sharks. Well, years later, one of the Navy guys was in town and dropped by and said, "Hey, do you still have that maze that we funded?" And he said, "Sure, why don't we set it up?" The sharks remembered it all those years. So they have long memories. That's one of the things that comes with being able to live to 70.
How could it be told that the sharks remembered it?
Oh, because they could negotiate the maze right away.
Right,
I mean, gosh, and I'm terrible. I mean, I'm like, where did I park? You know, I can't even remember where I was an hour ago, and they remember this stuff. So they're pretty great. They have all kinds of senses that we don't, and this is one of the things that fascinates me. They have these ampullae of Lorenzini, which if you look up close at the shark, they look like kind of freckles on their chin and their snout. And with these, they can detect the electrical currents given off by the beating hearts of their prey. Mm. And they also may be able to navigate using an electrical sense. They see and experience the world, the same world that we live in, the same planet that we consider ours, in a way that we never can. And so in that way, you know, they are more than human. They are superhuman. And they go back so far in time. And to me, you know, when I first saw that shark appearing out of the water in the distance, in the blue, I think one of the reasons that I felt so calm and at peace while at the same time excited was, here comes somebody who has run the ocean since the Devonian. You know, only recently have we even started to go in the ocean. Only recently have we even been on this water planet. And since we got in charge, we've screwed everything up. We have messed up the climate. And by 2050, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish. So I think one reason I was so thrilled to see that shark was I felt like, here comes somebody who knows what they're doing.
Right.
What
it was
a relief.
A chance to apologize to him, too, maybe.
Right.
So we're going to run out of time here, Cy, and there's so many things to talk to you about. But, you know, I'm more likely to die of a heart attack than a shark bite. Even if I went and thrashed around in the water off Wellfleet every day, I'd still be more likely to die of a heart attack. But if they had, say, Heart Attack Week on some TV channel and I could watch all these people having heart attacks, and then there was a couple of movies about people getting heart attacks where you watch, I wouldn't really partake of any of that. It doesn't really strike me as really interesting programming that I would really enjoy watching. So what is that up with us in sharks? Because we're so afraid of them and we overblow our fear of them, but we can't stop looking at them.
No, you're so right. Humans are fascinated by predators, and it makes evolutionary sense. I mean, gosh, for most of our lives as a species, we were hunter-gatherers, and we didn't really live long enough to have a heart attack. While we were walking over the savannah or whatever, we were more worried about being eaten by a giant lion or a smilodon or dying in childbirth or mm-hmm. You know, but looking at predators fascinates us, and it's extremely easy to learn to fear predators. People who did these unethical experiments many years ago would try to teach children to be afraid of, like, a spider versus a flower. You could make a child afraid of a flower, but it took much longer than to teach that child to be afraid of a spider or a snake, and we are the same way with sharks.
It makes sense. Well, Cy Montgomery, it's always so great to talk to you, and you are the easiest person to interview on the radio that I've ever met, and I've interviewed a lot of people. So
it's a joy talking with you, Paul.
All right. So Cy Montgomery, her essay in Eon, Danger Girl, What I Learned About Fear, Sex, Desire, and Dread from the Peculiar Pleasures of Diving with Great White Sharks. And you may also investigate one of her 28 or so books. I wanted to save a little time here at the end because I forgot to write the credits again. As has been mentioned, I think this show is a creation of our senior producer, Betsy Kaplan, who has collaborated with Cy in the past on our Octopus show. And Kion Wolf has been on the board, making everything sound really, really great. And Carolyn, our wonderful intern, has been on the phones. Thank you so much for listening. I'd say don't go near the water, but go near the water. Just don't be an idiot, all right? And don't get eaten. And if you do get eaten, don't blame me.